voice echoed between the buildings. Kristen went over to the entryway door with the child in her arms. "You'll have to unsaddle your own horse tonight, Ulf. All the men have gone off to the dance. It's a shame you should have to be troubled with this, but I'm afraid it can't be helped." Ulf muttered with annoyance, but he unsaddled the horse. Nokva and Björgulf swarmed around him and wanted to ride the horse over in the pasture. "No, Nokva, you must stay with Gauta. Play with your brother so he doesn't cry while I'm in the cookhouse," said Kristen. The boy frowned unhappily, but then he got down on all fours, roaring and butting at his little brother, whom Kristen had put down on a cushion near the entryway door. She bent down and stroked Nokva's hair. He was so good to his younger brothers. When Kristen came back to the hall holding the big trencher in her hands, Ulf Haldorsson was sitting on the bench, playing with the children. Gauta liked to be with Ulf as long as he didn't see his mother, but now he began crying at once and reached out for her. Kristen put down the trencher and picked Gauta up. Ulf blew on the foam of the newly tapped ale, took a swallow, and then began taking food from the small bowls on the trencher. "Are all of your maidservants out tonight?" Kristen said. "There are fiddles and drums and pipes. A group of musicians arrived from Orkadal after the wedding, and you know that as soon as they heard about them, they're young girls after all." "You let them run around too freely, Kristen. I think you're most afraid that it'll be hard to find a wet nurse this autumn." Kristen involuntarily smoothed down her gown over her slender waist. She had blushed dark red at the man's words. Ulf laughed harshly. "But if you keep carrying around Gauta this way, then things may go as they did last year. Come here to your foster father, my boy, and I'll give you some food from my plate." Kristen didn't reply. She set her three small sons in a row on the bench along the opposite wall, brought the basin of milk porridge, and pulled over a little stool close by. There she sat, feeding the boys, although Nokva and Björgulf grumbled. They wanted spoons so they could feed themselves. The oldest was now 4, and the other would soon be 3 years old. "Where's Erlend?" asked Ulf. "Margaret wanted to go to the dance, and so he went with her."
"It's good he understands he should keep a watchful eye on that maiden of his," said Ulf.
Again, Kristen did not reply. She undressed the children and put them to bed, Gauta in the cradle and the other two in her own bed. Erlend had resigned himself to having them there after she recovered from her long illness the year before. When Ulf had eaten his fill, he stretched out on the bench. Kristen pushed the chair carved from a tree stump over to the cradle, got her basket of wool, and began to wind up balls of yarn for her loom as she gently and quietly rocked the cradle. "Shouldn't you go to bed?" she asked once without turning her head. "Aren't you tired, Ulf?" The man got down, poked at the fire a bit, and came over to Kristen. He sat down on the bench across from her. Kristen saw that he was not as spent from carousing as he usually was whenever he had been in Nidaros for a few days.
"You don't even ask about news from town, Kristen," he said, looking at her as he leaned forward with his elbows on his knees.
Her heart began pounding with fear. She could see from the man's expression and manner that again there was news that wasn't good. But she said with a gentle and calm smile, "You must tell me, Ulf. Have you heard anything?"
"Yes, well..."
But first he took out his traveling bag and unpacked the things he had brought from town for her. Kristen thanked him. "I understand that you've heard some news in Nidaros," she said after a while. Ulf looked at the young mistress. Then he turned his gaze to the pale, sleeping child in the cradle.
"Does he always sweat like this?"
he asked softly, gently pushing back the boy's damp, dark hair.
"Kristen, when you were betrothed to Erlend, the document that was drawn up regarding the ownership of both your possessions, didn't it state that you should manage with full authority those properties which he gave you as betrothal and wedding gifts?"
Kristen's heart pounded harder, but she said calmly,
It's also true, Ulf, that Erland has always asked my advice and sought my consent in all dealings with those properties. Is this about the sections of the estate in Verdal that he has sold to Viglak of Ling?
Yes, said Ulf. He has bought a ship called Hugrekken from Viglak. So now he's going to maintain two ships. And what do you gain in return, Kristen?
Erland's share of Shervastad and two plots of land in Ulfkastad, each taxed by 1 month's worth of food. And what he owns of Armhammer, she said. Surely you didn't think Erland would sell that estate without my permission or without repaying me? Ulf sat in silence for a moment.
And yet your income will be reduced, Kristen. Shervastad. That was where Erland obtained hay this past winter, and in return he released the farmer from the land tax for the next 3 years.
Erland was not to blame because we had no dry hay last year. I know, Ulf. You did everything you could. But with all the misery we had here last summer, he sold more than half of Arhammer to the sisters at Rhine back when he was preparing to flee the country with you. Ulf laughed.
Or pledged it as security, which amounts to the same thing in Erland's case. Free of war levies, the entire burden rests on Audun, who oversees the farm which you will now call your own.
Can't he lease the land from the convent? Asked Kristen.
The nun's tenant farmer on the neighboring estate has leased it, said Ulf. It's difficult and risky for leaseholders to manage when lands are split up the way Erland is bent on doing.
Kristen was silent. She knew he was right.
Erland is working quickly, said Ulf, to increase his lineage and to destroy his property.
When she didn't reply, Ulf went on.
You will soon have many children, Kristen Lavrin's daughter.
But none I would give up, she said, with a slight quaver in her voice.
Don't be so fearful for Gauta. I'm sure he'll grow strong over time, said Ulf softly.
It must be as God wills, but it's difficult to wait. He could hear the concealed suffering in the mother's voice. A strange sense of helplessness came over the ponderous, gloomy man.
It's of such little avail, Kristen. You have accomplished much here at Husaby, but if Erland is now going to set off with two ships, I have no faith that there will be peace in the north, and your husband has so little cunning. He doesn't know how to turn to his advantage what he has gained in the past 2 years. Bad years they have been, and you have been constantly ill. If things should continue in this way, you'll be brought to your knees in the end, and as such a young woman. I've helped you as best I could here on the estate, but this other matter, Erland's lack of prudence.
Yes, God knows you have, she interrupted him. You've been the best of kinsmen toward us, Ulf, my friend, and I can never fully thank you or repay you.
Ulf stood up, lit a candle at the hearth, and set it in the candlestick on the table. He stood there with his back turned to Kristen. She had let her hands sink into her lap as they talked, but now she began winding up the yarn and rocking the cradle with her foot again. Can't you send word to your parents back home? He asked. So that Lavrans might journey north in the fall along with your mother when she comes to help you?
I hadn't thought of troubling my mother this fall. She's getting older, and it happens much too often now that I must lie down in the straw to give birth. I can't ask her to come every time.
Her smile looked a bit strained. Do it this time, said Ulf, and ask your father to come along, so you can seek his advice on these matters.
I will not ask my father's advice about this, she said quietly but firmly.
What about Gunnulf, then? Asked Ulf after a moment. Can't you speak to him?
It's not proper to disturb him with such things now, said Kristen in the same tone of voice.
Do you mean because he has entered a monastery?
Ulf laughed scornfully.
I've never noticed that monks had less understanding about managing estates than other people. When she didn't answer, he said, But if you won't seek advice from anyone, Kristen, then you must speak to Erlon. Think of your sons, Kristen.
She sat in silence for a long time. You, who are so good toward our children, Ulf, she said at last.
It would seem to me more reasonable if you married and had your own worries to tend to than that you should stay here, tormenting yourself with Erlan's and my troubles. Ulf turned to face her. He stood with his hands gripping the edge of the table behind him and looked at Kristin Lavransdatter. She was still straight-backed and slender and beautiful as she sat there. Her gown was made of dark, hand-dyed woolen cloth, but she wore a fine, soft linen wimple around her calm, pale face. The belt from which her ring of keys hung was adorned with small silver roses. On her breast glittered two chains with crosses, the larger one on gilded links which hung almost to her waist. That one had been given to her by her father. On top lay the thin silver chain with a little cross, which Orm had given to his stepmother, asking her to wear it always. So far she had recovered from each childbirth looking just as lovely as ever, only a little quieter, with heavier responsibilities on her young shoulders. Her cheeks were thinner, her eyes a little darker and more somber beneath the wide, white forehead, and her lips were a little less red and full. But her beauty would soon be worn away before many more years had passed, if things continued in this fashion. "Don't you think, Ulf, that you would be happier if you settled down on your own farm?" she continued. "Erlan told me that you've bought 3 more plots of land at Skjolvikstad. You will soon own half the estate. And Isak has only the one child. Åsa is both beautiful and kind, a capable woman, and she seems to like you."
"And yet I don't want her if I have to marry her," sneered the man crudely and laughed. "Besides, Åsa Isak's daughter is too good for—" His voice changed. "I've never known any other father but my foster father, Kristin. And I think it's my fate not to have any other children but foster children."
"I'll pray to the Virgin Mary that you'll have better fortune, kinsman."
"I'm not so young, either. 35 winters, Kristin," he laughed. "It wouldn't take many more than that, and I could be your father."
"Then you must have begun your sinful ways early," replied Kristin. She tried to make her voice sound merry and lighthearted.
"Shouldn't you go to sleep now?" Ulf asked.
"Yes, soon. But you must be tired too, Ulf. You should go to bed."
The man quietly bade her good night and left the room. Kristin took the candlestick from the table and shone the light on the two sleeping boys in the enclosed bed. Björgolf's eyelashes were not festering, thank God for that. The weather would stay fine for a while yet. As soon as the wind blew hard or the weather forced the children to stay inside near the hearth, his eyes would grow inflamed. She stood there a long time, gazing at the two boys. Then she went over and bent down to look at Gauta in his cradle. They had been as healthy as little fledglings, all 3 of her sons, until the sickness had come to the region last summer. A fever had carried off children in homes all around the fjord. It was a terrible thing to see and to hear about. She had been allowed to keep hers, all her own children. For 5 days she had sat near the bed on the south wall where they lay, all 3 of them, with red spots covering their faces and with feverish eyes that shunned the light. Their small bodies were burning hot. She sat with her hand under the coverlet and patted the soles of Björgolf's feet while she sang and sang, until her poor voice was no more than a whisper. "Shoo, shoo the knight's great horse. How are we to shoe it best? Iron shoes will pass the test. Shoo, shoo the earl's great horse. How are we to shoe it best? Silver shoes will pass the test. Shoo, shoo the king's great horse. How are we to shoe it best? Golden shoes will pass the test." Björgolf was less sick than the others, and more restless. If she stopped singing for even a minute, he would throw off the coverlets at once. Gauta was then only 10 months old. He was so ill that she didn't think he would survive. He lay at her breast, wrapped in blankets and furs, and had no strength to nurse. She held him with one arm as she patted the soles of Björgolf's feet with her other hand. Now and then, If all three of them happened to fall asleep for a while, she would stretch out on the bed beside them fully dressed. Erland came and went, looking helplessly at his three small sons. He tried to sing to them, but they didn't care for their father's fine voice. They wanted their mother to sing, even though she didn't have the voice for it. The servant women would come in, wanting their mistress to rest. The men would come in to inquire about the boys, and Orm tried to play with his young brothers. At Kristen's advice, Erland had sent Margaret over to Østerdal, but Orm wanted to stay. He was grown up now, after all. Sira Eiliv sat at the children's bedside whenever he wasn't out tending to the sick. Through work and worry, the priest had shed all the corpulence he had acquired at Husaby. It grieved him greatly to see so many fair young children perish. And some grown-ups had died, too. By the evening of the sixth day, all the children were so much better that Kristen promised her husband to undress and go to bed that night. Erland offered to keep watch along with the maids and to call Kristen if need be. But at the supper table, she noticed that Orm's face was bright red and his eyes were shiny with fever. He said it was nothing, but he jumped up abruptly and rushed out. When Erland and Kristen went out to him, they found him vomiting in the courtyard. Erland threw his arms around the youth. "Orm, my son, are you ill?" "My head aches," complained the boy, and he let his head sink heavily onto his father's shoulder. That night they kept vigil over Orm. Most of the time he lay there muttering in delirium, then screaming loudly and flailing his long arms about, seeming to see hideous things. What he said they could not understand. In the morning Kristen collapsed. It turned out that she must have been with child again. Now it went very badly for her, and afterwards she lay as if immersed in a death-like sleep. Later she was seized by a terrible fever. Orm had been in the grave for more than 2 weeks before she learned of her stepson's death. At the time she was so weak that she couldn't properly grieve. She felt so bloodless and faint that nothing seemed to reach her. She was content to lie in bed, only half alive. There had been a dreadful time when the women hardly dared touch her or tend to her cleanliness, but that had all merged with the confusion of the fever. Now it felt good to submit to the care of others. Around her bed hung many fragrant wreaths of mountain flowers which were meant to keep the flies away. The people from the mountain pastures had sent them, and they smelled especially sweet whenever there was rain in the air. One day Erland brought the children to her. She saw that they were haggard from their illness, and that Gaute didn't recognize her. But even that didn't trouble her. She merely sensed that Erland seemed always to be at her side. He went to Mass every day, and he knelt at Orm's grave to pray. The cemetery was next to the parish church at Vinyar. But some of the infants in the family had been given a resting place inside the manor church at Husaby. Erland's two brothers, and one of Munan Biskupsen's little daughters. Kristen had often felt sorry for these little ones who lay so alone under the flagstones. Now Orm Erlandsson had his final resting place among these children. While the others feared for Kristen's life, processions of beggars on their way to Nidaros just before St. Olav's Day began to pass through the region. They were mostly the same wandering men and women who had made the journey the year before. The pilgrims in Nidaros were always generous to the poor, since intercessions of this kind were considered particularly powerful. And they had learned to travel by way of Skaun during the years since Kristen had settled at Husaby. They knew that there on the estate they would be given shelter, alms, and an abundance of food before they continued on. This time the servants wanted to send them away because the mistress was ill. But when Erland, who had been up north the last 2 summers, heard that his wife was accustomed to receiving the beggars so kindly, he ordered that they should be given food and lodging, just as they had before. And in the morning he himself tended to the wanderers, helping the servants to pour the ale and bring in food for them. He gave them alms as he quietly asked for their prayers of intercession for his wife. Many of the beggars wept when they heard that the gentle young woman lay close to death. All of this Cira Iliv had told Kristen when she began to regain her health. Not until Christmas time was she strong enough to take up her keys again. Erlan had sent word to her parents as soon as she fell ill, but at the time they were in the south, attending a wedding at Skog. Later they came to Husaby. She was better by then, but so tired that she had little energy to talk to them. What she wanted most was simply to have Erland at her bedside. Weak and pale and always cold, she would cling to his healthy body. The old fire in her blood had gone. It had disappeared so completely that she could no longer remember how it felt to love in that way. But with it had also vanished the worry and bitterness from the past few years. She felt that things were better now, even though the sorrow over Orm's death lay heavily on both of them, and even though Erlan didn't realize how frightened she was for little Gauta. But things were so good between them. She saw that he had feared terribly that he might lose her. And so it was difficult and painful for her to speak to him, to touch on matters that might destroy the peace and joy they now shared. She was standing outside in the bright summer night, in front of the entrance to the main house, when the servants returned from the dance. Margaret was clinging to her father's arm. She was dressed and adorned in a fashion that would have been more suited to a wedding feast than to a dance out on the green, where all manner of folk came together. But her stepmother had stopped interfering in the maiden's upbringing. Erlan could do as he pleased in raising his own daughter. Erlan and Margaret were both thirsty, so Kristen brought ale for them. The girl sat and talked with them for a while. She and her stepmother were good friends now that Kristen no longer attempted to instruct her. Erlan laughed at everything his daughter said about the dance. But finally, Margaret and her maid went up to the loft to sleep. Erlan continued roaming around the hall. He stretched, yawned, but claimed he wasn't tired. He ran his fingers through his long black hair. There wasn't time for it after we were in the bathhouse. Because of the dance. I think you'll have to cut my hair, Kristen. I can't walk around like this during the holy days. Kristen protested that it was too dark, but Erland laughed and pointed to the vent hole in the ceiling. It was already daylight again. Then she relit the candle, told him to sit down, and draped a cloth around his shoulders. As she worked, he squirmed from the tickling and laughed when the scissors came too close to his neck. Kristen carefully gathered up the hair clippings and burned them in the hearth. She shook out the cloth over the fire as well. Then she combed Erlan's hair straight down from his scalp and snipped here and there, wherever the ends weren't quite even. Erlan grabbed her hands tightly as she stood behind him, placed them at his throat, and smiled as he tilted his head back to look up at her. But then he let her go, saying, "You're tired." And he stood up with a little sigh. Erlan sailed to Björgvin right after midsummer. He was disconsolate because his wife was again unable to travel with him. She smiled wearily. All the same, she wouldn't have been able to leave Gauta. And so Kristen was once again alone at Husaby in the summer. But she was glad that this year she wouldn't give birth until St. Matthew's Day. It would be difficult both for her and for the women who would attend her if it occurred during the harvest season. She wondered whether it would always be this way. Times were different now than when she was growing up. She had heard her father speak of the Danish War, and she remembered when he was away from home during the campaign against Duke Eirik. That was how he got the terrible scars on his body. But back home in the valleys, war had still seemed so far away, and no doubt most people thought it would never return. It was mostly peaceful, and her father was home, managing his estates, and thinking about and caring for all of them. Nowadays there was always unrest. Everyone talked about wars and campaigns and the ruling of the kingdom. In Kristen's mind, it all merged with her image of the sea and the coast, which she had seen only once since she had moved north. From the coast they sailed, and to the coast they came, men whose heads were full of ideas and plans and counterplots and deliberations, clergymen and laymen. To these men belonged Erlan, by virtue of his high birth and his wealth. But she felt that he stood partially outside their circles. She pondered and thought about this. What was it that caused her husband to have such a position? How did his peers truly regard him? When he was simply the man she loved, she had never asked about such things. She could see that he was short-tempered and impetuous and rash, that he had a particular penchant for acting unwisely. But back then she had found excuses for everything, never troubling to think about what his temperament might bring upon them both. When they had won her father's consent to marry, everything would be different. That was how she had consoled herself. Gradually it dawned on her that it was from the moment a child was born to them that she began to think about things. What kind of man was Erlan, whom people called irresponsible and imprudent, a man whom no one could trust? But she had trusted him. She remembered Brynhild's loft. She remembered how the bond between him and that other woman had finally been severed. She remembered his conduct after she had become his lawful bride. But he had stood by her in spite of all the humiliations and rejections, and she had seen that he did not want to lose her for all the gold on earth. She thought about Hoftor of Goder. He was always following her around, speaking words of nonsense and affection whenever they met, but she had never cared for his attentions. That must be his way of jesting. She didn't think it was more than that. She had been fond of the handsome and boisterous man, and she was still fond of him. But to think that anyone would act that way in mere jest... No, she didn't understand it. She had met Hoftor Grout again at the royal banquets in Nidaros, and he sought out her company there too, just as he usually did. One evening he convinced her to go into a loft room, and she lay down with him on a bed that stood there. Back home in Gudbrandsdal, she would never have thought of doing such a thing. There it was not a banquet custom for men and women to slip away, two by two. But here everyone did it. No one seemed to find it improper. It was apparently common practice among knights in other countries. When they first entered the room, Fru Aelin, the wife of Sir Erling, was lying on the other bed with a Swedish knight. Kristen could hear that they were talking about the king's earache. The Swede looked pleased when Fru Aelin wanted to get up and go back to the hall. When Kristen realized that Hoftor was quite serious about the intentions behind his request as they lay there and talked, she was so astonished that she failed to be either frightened or suitably indignant. They were both married, after all, and they both had children with their spouses. She had never truly believed that such things actually went on. In spite of all she herself had done and experienced, no, she hadn't believed that such things happened. Hoftor had always been merry and affectionate and full of laughter. She couldn't say that what he wanted was to try to seduce her. He hadn't been serious enough for that. And yet he wanted her to commit the worst of sins. He got off the bed the minute she told him to go. He had turned submissive, but he seemed more surprised than ashamed. And he asked in utter disbelief, did she truly think that married people were never unfaithful? But she must know that few men could admit to never having a paramour. Women were perhaps a little better than the men, and yet... Did you believe everything the priests preach about sin and the like, even back when you were a young maiden? He asked. Then I don't understand, Kristin Lavransdottir, how Erland ever managed to have his way with you. Then he looked into her eyes, and her eyes must have spoken, although she wouldn't have discussed this matter with Hoftor for any amount of gold. But his voice rang with amazement as he said, I thought that was only something they wrote about, in ballads. Kristin had not mentioned this episode to anyone, not even Erlan. He was fond of Hoftor. And of course it was dreadful that some people could behave as recklessly as Hoftor Grout, but she couldn't see that it was any concern of hers. And he hadn't attempted to be overly familiar toward her since then. Now, whenever they met, he would simply sit and stare at her with obvious astonishment in his sea-blue eyes. No, If Erland behaved rashly, it was not in that fashion, at any rate.
And was he truly so imprudent? She wondered. She saw that people were startled by things he said, and afterwards they would put their heads together to talk. There was often much that was truthful and just in the opinions that Erland Nikolaussen expressed. The problem was that he never saw what the other men never allowed to slip from view, the cautious hindsight with which they kept an eye on each other. Intrigue, Erland called it, and then he would laugh insolently, which seemed to provoke people at first but eventually won them over. They would laugh too, slap him on the shoulder, and say that he could be sharp-witted enough, but short-sighted. Then he would undo his own words with raucous and imprudent banter. And people tolerated a great deal of this sort of behavior from Erland. His wife was dimly aware of why everyone put up with his reckless talk, and it made her feel humiliated. For Erland would yield as soon as he encountered any man who held firm to his own opinion. Even if he understood no more than that this opinion was foolish, Erland would nevertheless relinquish his own view on the matter. But he covered his retreat with disrespectful gossip about the man. And people were satisfied that Erland had this cowardice of spirit. Reckless as he was with his own welfare, adventurous, and boldly enamored of any danger that could be faced with armed force. All the same, they had no need to worry about Erland Nikolaussen. The year before, toward the end of winter, the regent had come to Nidaros, and he had brought the young king along with him. Kristin attended the grand feast at the king's palace. With quiet dignity, wearing a silk wimple and with all her best jewelry adorning her red bridal gown, she had sat there among the most high-born women at the banquet. With alert eyes, she studied her husband's conduct among the men, watching and listening and pondering, just as she watched and listened and pondered wherever she went with Erland, and wherever she noticed that people were talking about him. And she had learned several things. Sir Erling Vidkunsen was willing to risk every effort to assert the right of the Norwegian crown north to the Gonvik Sea to defend and protect Hålogaland. But the council and the knights opposed him and were reluctant to support any endeavor that might help. The archbishop himself and the clergy of the archdiocese were not unwilling to offer financial support. This she knew from Gunnulf. But otherwise the men of the church all over the country were opposed to the war, even though it was against the enemies of God, heretics and heathens. And the noblemen were working against the regent, at least here in Trøndelag. They had grown accustomed to disregarding the words of the law books and the rights of the crown, and they were not pleased that Sir Erling so sternly invoked the spirit of his blessed kinsman King Håkon in these matters. But it was not for these reasons that Erland refused to allow himself to be used, as Kristin now understood that the regent had intended to use her husband. For Erland, it was simply because the other man's somber and dignified demeanor bored him, so he took revenge by lightly ridiculing his powerful kinsman. Kristin now thought she understood Sir Erling's attitude toward Erland. On the one hand, he had felt a certain affection for Erland ever since their youth. No doubt he thought that if he could win the support of the noble and fearless master of Husaby, who also had some experience in the art of war from the days when he served Earl Jakob, at any rate, more than most of the other men who had stayed at home, then it would be of benefit to both Erling Vidkunsen's plans and to Erland's welfare. But that's not how things had turned out. For 2 summers, Erland had stayed out at sea until late autumn, patrolling the waters off the long northern coast and chasing off pirate vessels with the 4 small ships that bore his banner. One day he had arrived in search of fresh provisions at a new Norwegian settlement far north in Tana, just as the Karelians were in the process of plundering it. With the handful of men he had brought ashore, he captured 18 of the pirates and hanged them from the roof beam in the half-burned barn. He cut down a troop of Russians attempting to flee into the mountains. He vanquished and burned several enemy ships somewhere out among the distant Skerries. Rumors of his speed and boldness spread through the north. His men from Outer Trøndelag and Møre loved their chieftain for his toughness
and his willingness to share in all the toil and travails of his crew. He had won friends among the peasants and the young sons on the estates of the chieftains up north in Hålogaland, where people had almost grown accustomed to having to defend their own coasts alone. But even so, Erland was of no help to the regent and his plans for a great crusade north. In Trøndelag, people boasted of Erland's exploits in the Russian campaign. If talk turned to this subject, they would point out that he was one of their own. Yes, it had turned out that the young boys from the fjord possessed a fair share of good old-fashioned valor. But no matter what Erland of Huseby said or did, it was not enough to impress grown-up and sensible men. Kristen saw that Erland continued to be counted among the young, even though he was a year older than the regent. She realized that this suited many, because then his words and actions could be disparaged as those of a young and reckless man. People liked him, humored him, and boasted of him, but he was never considered a fully entitled man. And she saw how willingly he accepted the role that his peers wanted him to play. He spoke in favor of the Russian war. He talked about the Swedes who shared the Norwegian king. But they refused to acknowledge the Norwegian lords and knights as noblemen, equal with their own. In other countries, for as long as the world had existed, had anyone ever heard of demanding payment of war levies from noblemen in any other form than having them ride their own horses and bear their own shields into battle? Kristen knew this was much the same thing her father had said that time at the Ting in Volga, and Lavrans had also mentioned it to Erland when his son-in-law had not wanted to oppose Munan Bardsson's plans. No, Erland now said, and he would allude to his father-in-law's powerful kinsmen in Sweden. He knew full well how the Swedish noblemen regarded the Norwegians. And if we don't show them what we're capable of, we'll soon be considered nothing more than wards of the Swedes. And people agreed that there was some truth to this. But then they would go back to talking about the regent. Sir Erling had his own reasons for lamenting what went on in the north. One year the Karelians had burned down Bjarker in defense of his overseer and persecuted his leaseholders. But Erland would change his tone and jest. Erling Vidkunsson wasn't thinking of his own affairs, he was sure of that. Sir Erling was such a noble and refined and distinguished knight. They couldn't have found a better man to serve as leader for all of them. By God, Erling was as honorable and venerable as the most beautiful golden initial capital at the beginning of the Book of Law. People laughed, less impressed with Erland's praise of the regent's integrity than with Erland's comparing him to a gilded letter. No, they didn't take Erland seriously. Not now, when he was in some ways respected. But back in the days when he was young and stubborn and desperate, when he lived with his concubine and refused to send her away in spite of the king's command and excommunication from the church, back then they did take him seriously, turning away from him in bitter fury at his ungodly and disgraceful life. Now it was all forgiven and forgotten. And Kristen realized that it was partly out of gratitude for this that her husband so willingly acquiesced and behaved in the way people wanted him to behave. He must have suffered bitterly during that time when he was banished from the company of his peers in Norway. But the problem was, it made her think of her father. When he released incompetent men from their obligations or debts with a mere shrug of his shoulders, it was a Christian duty to bear with those who could not conduct themselves properly. Was it in this manner that Erland had been forgiven the sins of his youth? But Erland had paid the consequences for his actions when he was living with Elina. He had answered for his sins right up until the moment when he met Kristen and she eagerly followed him into new sin. Was she then the one who... No. Now she was afraid of her own thoughts. And she tried to block out of her mind all the worries about things she could not change. She wanted only to think about matters in which she could do something with her compassion. Everything else she would have to place in God's hands. God had helped her in every instance when her own hard work could do some good. Huseby had now been transformed into a prosperous farm, as it had been in the past, in spite of the bad years. 3 healthy and handsome sons he had given her, and each year he had granted her new life whenever she was faced with death in childbirth. He had allowed her to recover her full health after each convalescence. She had been permitted to keep all 3 of her small sons the year before, when illness took the lives of so many fair children in the region. And Gauta would regain his health, that she firmly believed. It must be as Erland had said. It was necessary for him to lead his life and maintain his estates in as costly a fashion as he did. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to assert himself among his peers and win the rights and revenues that were his birthright under the crown. She would have to believe that he understood this better than she did. It was senseless to think that things might have been better in some ways for him, and even for her, back when he was living tangled up in sin with that other woman. In glimpses of memory, she saw his face from that time, ravaged with sorrow, contorted with passion. No, no, things were fine as they were now. He was merely a little too carefree and thoughtless. Erland returned home just before Michaelmas. He had hoped to find Kristen confined to bed, but she was still on her feet. She came to meet him out on the road. Her gait was terribly cumbersome this time, but she had Gauta in her arms as usual. The 2 older sons came running ahead of her. Erland jumped down from his horse and lifted the boys onto the saddle. Then he took his youngest son from his wife so he could carry him. Kristen's pale, worn face lit up when Gauta wasn't frightened by his father. He must have recognized him after all. She asked nothing about her husband's travels, but talked only about Gauta's 4 new teeth, which had made him so sick. Then the boy started to scream. He had scraped his cheek bloody on the filigree brooch on his father's chest. He wanted to go back to his mother, and she wanted to take him, no matter how much Erlan protested. Not until evening, when they were sitting alone in the hall and the children were asleep, did Kristen ask her husband about his journey to Björgvin, as if she only then happened to think about it. Erlan glanced furtively at Kristen. His poor wife. She looked so miserable. He began to tell her all kinds of news. Erling had asked him to send his greetings and give her this. It was a bronze dagger, corroded with verdigris. They had found it in a heap of stones out at Giske. It was supposed to be beneficial to place such a thing in the cradle in case it was rickets that had stricken Gauta. Kristen wrapped up the dagger again, awkwardly rose from her chair, and went over to the cradle. She put the bundle under the bedclothes with everything else that lay there. A stone axe found buried in the ground, the musk gland of a beaver, a cross made from daphne twigs, old silver, flint, roots of a Maria hand orchid, and an Olav's beard fern. "Lie down now, dear Kristen," Erland said tenderly. He came over and pulled off her shoes and stockings. All the while he talked. Håkon Ogmundsson had come back, and peace with the Russians and Karelians had been concluded and sealed. Erland himself would have to travel north this fall, for it was certain that calm would not be restored at once, and a man was needed at Vargr who knew the region. He would be given full authority as the king's officer in command at the fortress up there, which had to be better secured so that peace could be defended at the new border markers. Erland looked up into his wife's face with excitement. She seemed a bit alarmed, but she didn't ask many questions, and it was clear that she had little understanding of what his news meant. He saw how tired she was, so he spoke no more about this matter, but remained sitting on the edge of her bed for a while. He understood the gravity of what he had taken on. Erland laughed quietly to himself as he took his time undressing. There would be no sitting back with his silver belt around his belly, holding feasts for friends and kinsmen, and filing his nails straight and clean as he dispatched his vassals and lieutenants here and there, the way the king's commanders of the castles did here in the south of Norway. And the castle at Vargr was quite a different sort of fortress. Finns, Russians, Karelians, and mixed breeds of all kinds, troll rabble, conjurers, heathen dogs, the devil's own precious lambs who had to be taught to pay taxes to the Norwegian emissaries and to leave the Norwegian settlements in peace, which were spread out with as much distance between each other as from Husaby all the way to Mura. Peace. Perhaps the king's peace would be possible up there someday, but in his lifetime there would be peace only when the devil attended Mass. And he would have his own roughnecks to keep in check, too. Especially toward the spring, when they began to grow despondent from the darkness, and the cold, and the hellish roar of the sea. When the flour and butter and liquor were in short supply, and they began fighting over their women, and life on the island grew unbearable. Erland had witnessed some of this when he was there as a young boy with Gissur Gala. No, he wouldn't be lying about Idol. Ingolf Pate, who was now in charge, was able enough. But Erling was right. A man from the knighthood should take control of things up there. Not until then would anyone realize that it was the Norwegian king's firm intention to assert his power over the land. Ha ha, in that territory, he would be like a needle in a coverlet. Not a single Norwegian settlement until as far south as Malung. Ingolf was a capable fellow, but only as long as he had someone in command over him. He would put Ingolf in charge of his ship Hugrekken. Margigren was the most splendid of ships, that much he had now learned. Erland laughed softly and happily. He had told Kristin so often before, this was one mistress she would have to put up with. He was awakened by one of the children crying in the dark. Over by the bed on the opposite wall, he could hear Kristin stirring and speaking gently. It was Bjørgulf who was complaining. Sometimes the boy woke up in the night and couldn't open his festering eyes. Then his mother would moisten them with her tongue. Erland had always been repelled by the sight of this. Kristin was softly humming. The thin, weak sound of her voice annoyed him. Erland remembered what he had been dreaming. He was walking along a shore somewhere. It was low tide, and he was leaping from stone to stone. In the distance, the sea was glistening and pale, lapping at the seaweed. It was like a silent, cloudy summer evening with no sun. At the mouth of the silvery fjord, he saw the ship anchored, black and sleek, rocking gently on the waves. There was an ungodly, delicious smell of sea and kelp. His heart grew sick with longing. Now in the darkness of the night, as he lay here in the guest bed and listened to the monotonous sound of the lullaby gnawing at his ear, he felt how strong his longing was. To be away from this house and the swarms of children who filled it. Away from talk of farming matters and servants and tenants and children. And from his anguished concern for her, who was always ill and whom he always had to pity. Erland clasped his hands over his heart. It felt as if it had stopped. It merely lay there, shivering with fright inside his breast. He longed to be away from her. When he thought about what she would have to endure, as weak and frail as she now was, and he knew that it could happen at any hour, he felt as if he would suffocate from fear. But if he should lose Kristin, he didn't know how he would be able to live without her. But he didn't feel able to live with her either, not now. He wanted to flee from everything and breathe freely, as if it were a matter of life itself for him. Jesus, my savior. Oh, what kind of man was he? He realized it now, tonight. Kristin, my sweet, my dearest wife. The only time he had known deep, heartfelt joy with her was when he was leading her astray. He who had been so convinced on that day when he was given Kristin to have and to hold before God and man that everything bad would be driven from his life so completely that he would forget it had ever existed. He must be the kind of man who couldn't tolerate anything truly good or pure to be near him. Because Kristin, ever since she had emerged from the sin and impurity into which he had led her, she had been like an angel from God's heaven. Kind and faithful, gentle, capable, deserving of respect. She had returned honor to Husaby. She had become once again the person she had been on that summer night, when the pure young maiden had crept under his cape there in the convent garden, and he had thought when he felt that slender young body against his side, the devil himself wouldn't dare harm this child or cause her sorrow. Tears streamed down Erlan's face. It must be true, what the priests had told him, that sin ate up a man's soul like rust, for he could find no rest or peace here with his sweet beloved. He longed to be away from her and everything that was hers. He had wept himself almost to sleep when he sensed that she was up and pacing the floor, quietly humming and singing. Erlan sprang out of bed, stumbled in the dark over a child's shoes on the floor, and went right over to his wife and took Gauta from her. The boy started screaming, and Kristen said crossly, "I had almost lulled him to sleep." The father shook the crying child, gave him a few slaps on the bottom, and when the boy shrieked even louder, he hushed him so harshly that Gauta fell silent with fear. Nothing like that had ever happened to him before.
"It's time for you to use what good sense you have, Kristen."
His fury robbed him of all power as he stood there, startled and naked and freezing in the pitch-dark room with a sobbing child in his arms.
"There has to be an end to this, I tell you. What do you have nursemaids for? The children will sleep with them. You can't keep on this way."
"Won't you allow me to have my children with me during the time I have left?" replied his wife, her voice low and plaintive. Erlan refused to acknowledge what she meant.
"During the time you have left, you need rest. Go to bed now, Kristen," he implored her more calmly.
He took Gauta with him to bed. He hummed to him for a while, and in the dark he found his belt lying on the step of the bed. The little silver medallions adorning it clinked and clattered as the boy played with the belt. "The dagger isn't in it, is it?" asked Kristen anxiously from her bed, and Gauta began howling again when he heard his mother's voice. Erland hushed him and made the belt clink. At last the child stopped crying and grew calm. Perhaps it would be unwise to wish for this poor little boy to grow to adulthood. It was not certain that Gauta possessed all his wits. "Oh no, oh no. Blessed Virgin Mary, he didn't mean that. He didn't wish death for his own little son. No, no." Erland held the child close in his arms and pressed his face to the soft, fine hair. "They're handsome sons." But he grew so weary of listening to them all day long, of stumbling over them whenever he came home. He couldn't understand how three small children could be everywhere at once on such a large estate. But he remembered how furious he had been with Alina because she showed no interest in their children. He must be an unreasonable man, for he was also resentful that he no longer saw Kristen without children clinging to her. When he held his lawfully born sons in his arms, he never felt the same way he had when they gave him Orm to hold for the first time. "Oh, Orm, Orm, my son." He had been so tired of Alina by then, sick and tired of her stubbornness and her vehemence and her uncontrollable ardor. He had seen that she was too old for him. And he had begun to realize what this madness would eventually cost him. But he hadn't felt that he could send her away, not after she had given up everything for his sake. The boy's birth had given him a reason to tolerate the mother, it seemed to him. He had been so young when he became Orm's father, and he hadn't fully understood the child's position since the mother was another man's lawful wife. Sobs overcame him once more, and he held Gauta tighter. Orm. He had never loved any of his children the way he loved that boy. He missed him terribly, and he bitterly regretted every harsh and impatient word he had ever said to him. Orm couldn't have known how much his father loved him. Bitterness and despair had gradually seized Erland as it became abundantly clear that Orm would never be considered his lawful son, and that he would never be able to inherit his father's coat of arms. And Erland felt jealousy too, because he saw his son draw closer to his stepmother than to him, and it seemed to him that Kristen's calm, gentle kindness toward the boy was a form of reproach. Then came those days and nights that Erlan could not bear to remember. Orm lay on his bier in the loft, and the women came to tell him that they didn't think Kristen would live. They dug a grave for Orm over in the church, and they asked whether Kristen should be buried there too. Or should she be taken instead to St. Gregor's church, to be laid to rest beside his parents? Oh. He held his breath in fear. Behind him lay an entire lifetime of memories from which he had fled, and he couldn't bear to think of it. Now, tonight, he understood. He could forget about it to some extent from day to day, but he couldn't protect himself from the memories turning up at some moment such as this, and then it felt as if all courage had been conjured out of him. Those days at Haugen, he had almost succeeded in forgetting about them entirely. He hadn't been back to Haugen since that night when he drove off, and he hadn't seen Bjorn or Asild again after his wedding. And now, he thought about what Munan had told him. It was said that their spirits had come back. Haugen was so haunted that the building stood deserted. No one wanted to live there, even if they were given the farm free. Bjorn Gunnarsson had possessed a type of courage that Erland knew he himself would never have. His hand had been steady when he stabbed his wife. Right through the heart, said Munan. It would be 2 years this winter since Bjorn and Fru Asheel died. People had not seen smoke coming from the buildings at Haugen for nearly a week. Finally, several men gathered their courage and went over there. Herr Bjorn was lying in bed with his throat cut. He was holding his wife's body in his arms. On the floor next to the bed lay his bloody dagger. Everyone knew what had happened. And yet Munan Bardsson and his brother managed to have the two buried in consecrated ground. Perhaps they had fallen victim to robbers, people said, although the chest containing Bjorn's and Asheild's valuables had not been touched. And the bodies were untouched by mice or rats. In fact, those kinds of vermin never came to Haugen, and people took this as a sign of the woman's sorcery skills. Munan Bardsson had been terribly distressed by his mother's death. He had set off on a pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela at once. Erland remembered the morning following his own mother's death. They were anchored in Molder Sound, but the fog was so white and thick that only occasionally could they catch a glimpse of the mountain ridge towering above them. But there was a muffled echo from the hollow sound of the boat being rowed to shore with the priest. Erland stood in the bow and watched them rowing away from the ship. Everything he came near was wet with fog. Beads of moisture covered his hair and clothing. And the priest and his acolyte, who were strangers to Erland, sat in the bow of the boat, their shoulders hunched as they bent over the holy vessels they held on their laps. They looked like hawks in the rain. The slap of the oars and the scrape of the oarlocks and the echo from the mountain continued to resound long after the boat had been spirited away by the fog. On that day, Erland had also vowed to make a pilgrimage. He had only had one thought back then, that he be allowed to see his mother's lovely, sweet face again, the way it had been before, with its soft, smooth, light tan complexion. Now she lay dead below decks, with her face ravaged by the terrible sores that ruptured and seeped little drops of clear fluid whenever she had tried to smile at him. He was not to blame for the way his father had received him, nor for the fact that he had turned to someone who was outcast like himself. But then Erland had pushed the pilgrimage from his mind, and he had refused to think any more about his mother. As painful as her life had been here on earth, she must now be in that place of peace. And there was not much peace for him after he took up with Alina again. Peace. He had known it only once in his life. On that night when he sat behind the stone wall near the woods of Hofvin and held Kristen as she slept on his lap. The safe, tender, undisturbed sleep of a child. He hadn't been able to hold out for long before he shattered her tranquility. And it wasn't peace that he found with her later on, and he had no peace with her now. and yet he saw that everyone else in his home did find peace in the presence of his young wife. Now he longed only to go away to that strife-torn place. He yearned madly and wildly for that remote promontory and for the thundering sea surrounding the forelands of the north, for the endless coastline and the enormous